Hey, it's me, Richie T, and it's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It's episode 95, wherein we visit with Melissa Dalton Bradford, a woman who's written the book Global Mom, and we talk all about her travels and about an unfortunate situation with her son. Stick around for it. It's a pretty good one. I like her. She's absolutely charming and well-spoken. Talks about what it's like living out of the country and what the church is like in various parts of the world. So check that out. It's the second and third block. Right now, though, a couple of things of note. I wanted to share this. In our latest articles of news, we talked about what it means to be Mormon and had a few people kind of get back in touch with us. I wanted to share one of them with you. This is Hiram says, last podcast, you guys talked about being a Mormon, even though you don't believe. Not necessarily that we don't believe, but just the idea of being Mormon without believing. Hiram says, I'm atheist and classify myself as a Mormon. My name, Hiram, is a Mormon name. My ancestors were Mormon. It's in my blood. I also have the same values as Mormons. So I consider myself a, quote, Mormon. So thanks, Hiram. He did that on our Facebook page. Make sure you check us out on Facebook. Also, Dallin. Dallin writes, yo, yo, yo. I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed the Elijah Abels episode. I'd like to hear more episodes with the Mormon History Guy going over historical topics. As always, love the podcast and will continue to tell my friends about it. So thanks, Dallin. Vaunda, or Vanda, is how I'm pretty sure you say it, wants to say, hey, you know what? I think you should get the folks from the Meridian Magazine. If you haven't checked that out, that's an online LDS magazine. You should get those folks on. I think the historian in this particular article, which I have now posted at theculturalhall.com, points out knowing the truth about church history and not having it be a basis for leaving the church. So check that out. So thank you, Vaunda. And then finally, Emily, this is a little bit, this is also from our Facebook page and a little bit old. She says, I've tested the theory about the password for internet access at church buildings being capital P Pioneer 47. So far, she says, the results are thus. Sydney? Yes, that's the password. Surfers Paradise, Australia? Yes. Siem Reap, Cambodia, does not have the internet. Hanoi, Vietnam? No, although the internet there was wonky, so might have had something to do with it not working. Hong Kong? Password? Yes, is Pioneer 47. And Hong Kong Temple, with the patron housing? Also a yes. So I'm pretty sure it's Pioneer 47 throughout the church, so check that out. Other things to share with you. This one from Tu Madre says, yo, I was listening a couple of weeks ago and I'm now just getting around to writing you about Google Plus. I miss around there on a bit and would be happy to volunteer my non-expertise services to head up a Cultural Hall Google Plus profile. Let me know what you think. So if everyone can sustain Tu Madre, we're going to go ahead and do that. We have now done that. You can check it out. If you go to Google Plus, if you have an account, make sure you add us or friend us or group us or truthfully, I don't know how that works, but we have it and we're working on it and it will be more and more greatness and another way for you to get at the Cultural Hall. And then finally, this email came from someone going to theculturalhall.com and going to the Contact Us page. Says, hey, Cultural Hall, my name is Nick Thacker. I'm a graduate student at Loyola Marymount University studying screenwriting. I'm Mormon and a graduate of BYU's film program. I heard about you through Jeff Parkin, who was recently interviewed about Mormon film and storytelling. I worked as the head writer on Jeff and Jared Carden's pretty darn funny web series, the first season, and I loved your interview with Jeff. I write a blog about film and storytelling, often from a Mormon perspective, and I wanted to share a post I wrote about what film ratings mean to Latter-day Saints in a global church. I think it's an important topic that always generates worthwhile discussion. If you find it interesting, I'd love to have it passed/ featured through your podcast and website. So if you go to that today, that being Friday, the 9th of August, you can check out that. That's posted on our Facebook page and leave your comments there. Thanks, Nick. Thank you for emailing us. Thank you all for listening. And also, thanks for the great new reviews on our iTunes. You can always subscribe to the podcast there. You can also get us through the LDS Podcast app. You can also find us on Stitcher and listen that way on your phone or however ways you want to do it. You can also download a bunch of episodes and then go on a family vacation. That's how I've heard of it being most done. At least, that's how my dad does it, really, is all I meant by that. Okay, second, third block, Cultural Hall. It's Global Mom. Keep it here.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5500. To book your shoot today.
Time for the second block of the Cultural Hall, and joining us here is Melissa Dalton Bradford. We're going to get into the hyphen name here in a minute because that's a sensitive thing in my household. just to give you a brief introduction to Melissa Dalton Bradford, she is a writer, an independent scholar, world citizen, and mother. She holds a BA in German and an MA in comparative literature, which you're going to have to explain to me what that is here in a second. From BYU. She speaks, reads, and writes fluent German, French, and Norwegian, is conversant in Mandarin, and has taught language, humanities, and writing on the university level. I'm tired already, but there's still more.
And I'm still tired.
Bradford has performed professionally as a soprano soloist and actress in the United States, Scandinavia, Central Europe, and Southeast Asia. She and her husband have built their family in Vienna, Hong Kong, the New York City area, Oslo, Paris, Munich, Singapore, and Geneva. Welcome to the Cultural Hall.
Thank you very much.
She's also the author of the book Global Mom, which we'll talk about and share with what all that is. Thank you so much for being here. And
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And bring in your silent friend here.
Yes, a silent friend in the corner who shall remain nameless.
And we won't hear from her, too.
No.
So for all anyone knows, there is no silent friend.
Yeah, she's a phantom, a Swiss phantom. That's who she is.
How is it that we're so lucky to have you here? It sounds like the fact that you're here in the Cultural Hall in Utah is kind of just a happenstance.
It is. It's unusual. I do live in Geneva, Switzerland now, but every year I try to come back to my roots. And that's Utah. I was raised in Utah Valley, and nearly every summer over these last 20-something years that I've lived outside of Utah, I try to come back. This is where my parents still live. My younger brother still lives with his family. My husband was raised in Utah Valley, was born and raised all of his life in the same home in Aspen Avenue in Provo, Utah. And so we come back here to, you know, see friends. A lot of our international friends also congregate in Utah. They tend to.
Sure. We call it the pilgrimage.
The Mormon pilgrimage. This is our Mecca. This is our Mecca that we return to. And we come now, over the last 6 years, we've come for an annual memorial for one of our children. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so just this weekend, I was in the mountains with friends from Singapore, France, Germany, Switzerland, both coasts of the U.S., and we were memorializing this child by hiking part of the way up Mount Timpanogos.
Cool.
And so that is what I was doing this summer in particular. It happens to coincide with the launch of this book. And so at the same time that we're planning this annual memorial for our child, we're also launching this book, at the heart of which is the story of this child as well. And it incorporates all of these cultures from around the planet. They come together. We eat, we hike, we walk under waterfalls, we laugh, and we enjoy one another's company, and we talk about this child, and we talk about the things that are most important in life. And we launched this book this very week.
Jeez.
So I get to be here with you.
And then you get to take a nap at some point, right?
At some point. It's probably going to be on an airplane, but we know how airplane sleep is. It's kind of, that's an oxymoron.
It's not sleep.
No,
It is not. Eyes closed,
exactly.
Sitting.
It's drooling in different positions of discomfort. That's what it is.
Do you have the pillow? Do you have the Nick pillow?
I do. I have a really big one.
Yeah.
And sometimes you walk out of the airplane and you still have it on and you've forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's an accessory.
Yeah.
It's this fluorescent orange.
It's like, I'm not an
accessory.
Ox. I just forgot this harness thing around my neck.
Exactly.
I feel like that's what they kind of look like. So I guess the best way to start into this is, how is it that you met your husband? You guys both from Utah.
Oh, you're going to love this.
Yes.
This is the best story. We traced back that we probably sang at a patriotic choral event when we were maybe 11 or 12 years old. That was when my family arrived in Utah from living other places in the U.S. My father has been or was a professor at Brigham Young University for 35 plus years. My husband's father was a professor for 50 years.
Oh my gosh.
Reed Bradford is his name. So he was sort of a legend at BYU. And
what
did
he teach?
He taught sociology. That was his first discipline, but he was a religion professor.
Oh, cool.
Yes. And so we've traced back that somewhere in our memorabilia, we found that we had the same program from this patriotic choral event that we must have sung in. We must have been standing in the bleachers at the same time singing the national anthem and America for Me and tunes like that.
Mm-hmm.
But where it was a reality for me was in high school. We both graduated from Provo High School. And
you both went to the same high school?
We did.
Different times?
Same time.
Same times, even.
But I had a crush on his best friend.
Oh, jeez.
I had a crush on his best friend, and so I sort of eyed his best friend over the years in high school, and I always saw this friend, this other friend, this we called him Randy in mm-hmm. those days, Randy Bradford, as the most wonderful, stalwart, good-hearted young man, and definitely someone who's going to probably stay in Utah and raise a wonderful Mormon family in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up becoming my best buddy. And we both served German-speaking missions for the LDS Church.
Okay.
He went to Munich, returned from his mission. I had decided to go on a mission and received my call to Vienna.
Okay.
And so, this part you're going to love. He was teaching at the Missionary Training Center.
Oh, geez.
And and I said, I called him Range, because mm-hmm. his name is Randall James. So the contraction of his name is Range. I said, Range, I got my mission call to Vienna. This is great. And he said, fantastic, I'll arrange to be your teacher. So he was my teacher in the MTC. And
at this time, it's just friends.
Absolutely platonic. And I just thought, you are the most remarkable man that I know. And I'm certain that I'm going to go off and live my life in Kuwait or
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have this steady life in Utah Valley.
And that was what you wanted, and that was what he wanted.
That's what I anticipated, that I would probably, and there's a whole backstory to that we won't get into, but I would probably end up living outside of the U.S. It has something to do with my upbringing, with my parents speaking languages and taking us to travel and live in many different places outside of the U.S.
Sure.
When I was very young, and something sort of snagged my heart, and I thought, that's for me. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to end up doing. Well, I have Elder Bradford as my MTC teacher, and we exchanged exactly one letter the whole time I was on my mission.
It's like, I love you, wait for me, I'll be home soon.
It wasn't even that. It was, whoever you're dating, she's not worthy.
Yeah.
She's not worth it. She's not worth you.
Was that really? Good. Was it a thing where whoever, it kind of clicked?
No, I just kind of said, whoever it is, I'm sure she's not good enough. We'll just, but with no intention that this was going to become an item,
uh-huh.
that this was going to become a marriage, I just thought, you're pretty great, and I'm going to have to approve of whoever you marry.
Okay.
And then I came home on a Friday night, called him at home on a Saturday morning. He wasn't there. He was out playing tennis, and I wanted to give him the message that I'm home. Come to my homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
He came the next day. He walked in with, do you remember that I had a crush on his best friend? Remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Walked in with that friend, who by this time was married, walked in the back of the chapel. I saw the best friend, absolute leaden feeling on my part.
Just nothing.
Flat. But I saw him, and I thought, he's so remarkable. He's immediately, I thought, what was wrong with my vision before? What did I not see? So I strode right up to him, and I embraced this best friend, and I embraced his new bride, and I walked up to Elder Bradford, and I shook his hand.
Oh, awesome.
Hello, hello. And he invited me to the MTC the next day, because he was teaching there, and from that day on, we saw each other every single day. I started teaching at the MTC. We played footsies under the table in the cafeteria with the elders and sisters that we taught, and the day that we got engaged, did you want me to tell you this
yes,
whole story?
Please.
You want every detail?
Yeah, every bit.
Okay. the day that then he asked me to marry him formally, and the ring and everything, was the day that my first district of missionaries was flying.
Huh.
So we did this little thing where we arrived for a farewell and we wanted to have a last sort of devotional together. We went around the circle, talked with all of the missionaries, and it was moving for me because this was my first group of missionaries
yeah.
that were going out.
Like proud parent moment.
It was. I felt like a mother to these elders and sisters, and I can remember every single one of their names. Sister Allen, Sister Mangum, Elder Weeks, Elder Rodman, Elder Knapp. I remember all of them. They were sitting in this semicircle. And when they finished, Elder Bradford was sitting there, because that's what we call them in the MTC. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is one of the most important days of my life. And they looked at me, so flattered that I would be so moved, that this was so important that these missionaries were leaving. And I said, about an hour ago, Elder Bradford asked me to marry him. And instantly, the elder said, ah, flip, I knew it. I knew it. And the sisters... saw it all of the time. And with that, we were engaged. And a few months later, we were married in the Manti Temple. And a little over five years after that, after having our first child, Parker, we were off. We went and we lived in Vienna together. We lived in Hong Kong together. And then our international life as a family began in Norway. And that's a little over 20 years ago.
So how does that go, though? Because you give me the understanding that it's like he's Utah County born, bred, and
exactly.
has no idea or no thought to leaving. So how
right.
does that happen?
Good question.
Because he's a smart man. He followed you and said, hey, let's do it.
Let's do it. It was somewhere in our courtship where we started discussing how much our missions had meant for us, how much we loved German-speaking everything. And he had also sort of caught that fire. When he was a missionary, he took the language learning aspect of a mission really seriously. Mm-hmm. He speaks to this day beautiful German, and that was a big plus for me.
I think you're a little biased, but I bet it's pretty good German.
Yeah, no, when he speaks, Germans don't know that he's American.
Oh, really?
That he's German, yes. So he speaks very beautiful German, and I love that. And he, when we lived in Vienna together, before we had children, a year and a half after we married, we felt the same draw, something that is almost inexplicable, mm-hmm. spoke to us that this is what our future was going to be about. It was going to be about raising our family outside of the U.S. And because I was so game for it, and because he thought he could do it, we could do it together as a team, mm-hmm. I think. Had we not been a team, I don't know whether that would have materialized. But because we were a team together, we both spoke German, we wanted to learn other languages, we wanted our children to be exposed to that, it was a given for us. And then we had our first child and we moved to Hong Kong for a season, for several months, and that just nailed it for us. This is what we're going to do. We saw that other families were able to do it, and we would make it happen. So when he took his first job right out of business school, he graduated from the Marriott School of Management.
Cool.
While I was doing my master's in that discipline that we'll have to discuss later because...
Yeah, the comparative language.
The comparative literature.
Oh,
right.
Literature.
We'll talk about that in a moment. when he graduated then from business school, he was job hunting and he let every company know that he wanted to be on the international track.
Cool.
And his first company said, we can make this happen. And it happened really quickly. Within 2 years, we were moving from the New York City area to Norway with our two little children.
Hmm.
And we've been out ever since. Yeah.
Jeez.
20-something years.
Was there ever any sort of, nerves about... Because everything that I've read about with raising kids is that kids thrive in structure and normalcy. And to me, there doesn't seem anything that is structured or normal about, this address now is Hong Kong. Now we're going to be in Switzerland
Norway,
or
yes,
wherever.
Exactly. That is a very insightful question. Thank you for asking that. That is one of the great challenges of this lifestyle, is trying to create some sort of stability, mm-hmm. even though you're nomadic. And I've thought often of the nomadic families of our scriptural heritage. I think of the families of Lehi and Sariah. I think of the whole Judeo-Christian heritage of mm-hmm. people who pack up with their camels and their animal skin gourds, and they go out into the desert and they live there, but they must have something that is stable.
Yeah.
They must have something within the context of their family that is immutable. And for me, it's my faith. For me, it's my church membership. Wherever we go in the world, everywhere we go, be it Tanzania, be it Istanbul, be it Warsaw, be it Hong Kong or the Philippines, we always find a community of saints, of the LDS. And so everywhere we've been, we've always been caught by that network. So that is that's a big strength, I think, that we have. And my friends who observe my life as non-Mormons comment on the same thing. They say, everywhere you go, you already have a family waiting for you. And I say, yeah, that's right. Granted, we have to learn the language so that we can become part of that family, but they're always there. And so there's a consistent link from location to location. Other than that, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to try and create something normal in your children's
like how?
Lives.
Like what do you have to do?
Mm. Well, you have routines. You have daily routines that just you don't ever change from. You always have your prayer and your scripture study, and along with those essentials that really for me are the pylons that hold my life in place.
Mm-hmm.
My life gets shaky when those things are not in place. And my whole family's life gets shaky if those are not in place for me personally.
Sure.
Then you have to look for other things. You have to immediately establish some sort of a crescent of friends for your children. You have to go out and try and find good friends for your children because they can fall easily into other circles of friends. You have to scramble to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Physically, I try to make my home have certain consistent elements. For instance, one of the major players in this book, Global Mom, is our Norwegian farm table. We got it within the first few months that we moved in Norway, which was our first major international assignment when we moved as a family, as mm-hmm. a young. It's 3 meters long and it's 2 meters.
You're going to have to help me. 3 meters and 2 meters.
How long is that?
I'm dumb American.
It's like 9 feet long. It's like 9 feet long.
Okay.
And it's about 3 feet, 3 feet wide.
Okay.
This big hunk of pine.
Mm-hmm.
And the Norwegians love to gather and eat and talk for hours. And so we take that table with us everywhere we go. And that's where we start gathering people.
Oh, cool.
We bring people into our home. We learn their language. We learn their cuisine. We have them coach us on their culture. They spread their maps out on our table and they show us, here's where you should travel. Here's where you should swim. Here's where you should kayak. Here's where you should boat. And we exchange ideas, and that's happened everywhere we've moved. So that's something that we try to do to keep things consistent.
You talk about how everywhere you go within the communities of the church that they're, you know, you have that kind of built-in community.
Yeah.
Are there differences that you just went, whoa, this is
yeah.
this is so different within the church
yes.
in this area than somewhere else? And talk about maybe one or two of those.
Yes, thank you for asking that question, because when people say, I love to go anywhere in the world because the church is always the same, I swallow hard and I think, really?
Yeah.
Really? The doctrine might be the same, but the cultures are so different mm-hmm. where you go. I will give you an example. In Paris, this might be a surprise to people who haven't lived or spent a lot of time in Paris, but there's a big Northern African community in Paris.
Hmm.
So when you stand on the stage or on the estrade, as we call it in French, so you stand
the pulpit,
overlooking a stake conference, for instance,
mm-hmm.
so a regional conference in Paris, you see mostly dark hair, darker skin, darker eyes, and someone like me who's blonde and Nordic looking mm-hmm. really stands out. And so you have all that wonderful, colorful, loose, passionate culture of the African peoples and the Northern African heritage that is imposed on your very Scandinavian, Germanic, American heritage, which is really at the heart of Mormonism,
mm-hmm.
or at least used to be. You know, Utah was settled by so many, what my ancestors, Scandinavian pioneers and the Brits, etc. So you go to a church program in Paris, and in the middle of, you know, your recitation of the Gospel of Luke,
mm-hmm.
out of the back of the chapel will come your Senegalese sister playing bongo drums, and she's singing at the top of her lungs some African Christian song,
mm-hmm.
a Christmas song with bongo drums. And this is completely normal and acceptable, because this is part of the culture.
Yeah.
And I miss that when I'm away from that. Mm. Here's another example. It's also African-linked. Our daughter, Claire.
How old?
She's now a missionary in Rome.
Oh,
she's
wow.
She's 22.
Oh, so she got the easy mission call.
Yeah, that's what yeah. it is. That's right.
they're coming
right.
in by the thousands there in Rome.
Right, exactly.
Catholic Church? Never
yeah,
even
no
heard of
problem.
It.
No problem. Pope? What?
Yeah, what?
It's an exciting time to be a missionary there, though, because they're
the
anticipating
temple.
The group. Yeah, the it's construction of the temple. So when Claire, before she applied to be a missionary, sent in her papers to receive her call to be a missionary, she worked in Tanzania in Africa
okay.
for several months. And so we went to visit her in Arusha, and we went to church there. There is a little congregation in Arusha of about maybe 20,
wow.
20 local members, and then there are all the missionaries, and there are the senior couples that are there. It was so touching for me to be sitting in the back of this little converted ramshackle home where all of these people were essentially congregating in a living room, and see the branch presidency of this congregation. And I have to create a visual for you and for our listeners. As the branch president or one of his counselors started to talk, I noticed that his earlobe had a huge hole.
Like a gauge? Like
he had bigger than it? A gauge. Okay. Bigger than a gauge. So it's really like 3 inches wide and 3 inches long, his entire earlobe.
Wow.
Because he had been a Maasai. The Maasai tribesmen, as one of their rites of passage, they cut these big holes in their earlobes. And so you can identify the Maasai wherever you go in Tanzania and also neighboring countries. So here he was, a convert to Mormonism, who had this entire heritage, as faithful as everything. This is also the gospel of Jesus Christ. You might not look like whatever we might envision a poster boy of Mormonism to be like, but this is my brother.
Right.
My Maasai brother. Mm-hmm. That's perhaps a variation on the norm of church culture.
I think it sounds awesome. Coming
it
up in
awesome.
in the third block, we'll continue to talk to Melissa Dalton Bradford. We'll talk a little bit more about Global Mom, and then we'll get to talking about Parker. That's coming back in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Right, we're back here in the third block. It's Melissa Dalton Bradford. Let's just briefly, let's talk about the hyphen.
I am Melissa Dalton Bradford. I retained that name as a writer to distinguish me from another Melissa Bradford that must be someplace. At least someone alerted me to the fact that there was another Melissa Bradford. Maybe she's British or something. But in my academic writings that precede this book, I was always Melissa Dalton Bradford. So my family is Dalton.
Okay.
And I married into Randall's family, and I've kept it. I know it seems a little bit heavy, but it is part of my identity, and I'm
proud. I just bring it up because I always give my wife a hard time. She didn't take my last name at all, and I'm just like, come on!
Yeah.
Some part of it. Hyphen it. Put it on your driver's license, and
somewhere,
that's fine. Just so that somewhere, something.
Somewhere.
I'm like, Facebook, will you please? Just somewhere so that I know it's part of it. And
yes.
I'm
very much, I've seen that I'm a fused identity. I really am very much Dalton. I carry a great deal of Dalton in that heritage with me. And then Bradford as well. And my kids go by Bradford. You know, in many different countries, the woman doesn't take the man's last name.
Oh, yeah.
Or the children will be, my children would be Bradford Dalton or, well, any configuration of these names.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It's a pretty fascinating thing.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about Global Mom. So why write this down? Why not just keep the experiences with you and your family?
Thank you for asking that question. I felt compelled to write this story because for me as a woman, the move from being a mother who was launching a career in the New York City area with her two small children to abruptly aborting that and then following my husband's career and moving in the middle of a very dark winter to the tundra of Norway and being a stay-at-home mother and reconfiguring my identity, figuring out life again, redefining myself, that was a very big move for me, geographically, obviously, as well as internally.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned so endlessly much. To this day, when people say, but you were working in theater, and in New York, and New Jersey.
Someone would say that you were living, quote, the dream.
Yes, yeah. In many ways. And they say, don't you miss that a lot? And I take a deep breath, and I reflect, and I want to answer thoughtfully, and not in any glib cliche. And it's true that I have missed elements of that ability to express myself on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I thank heaven every day for that move. It plucked me out of one life track that I'm certain would have been rich and exciting, But for our family, this has been so deeply formative for all of us. It launched a life of global living that has formed each of our children. And that was part of my decision to say, yeah, honey, we'll go. I'll leave this show and this contract, and we will move right now to a place I don't know. I don't speak a word of the language. I'm going to be a mother at home with my children. That taught me more. I'm not prescribing this for anyone else. I'm just describing my personal experience. This was such a revelation for me of how deeply challenging and then rewarding this would be for me. And so what followed that one decision to say, yes, we'll go, has turned into over two decades of having my children be raised in the world out there. And lo and behold, on top of that, I also got opportunities to perform along the way. So it wasn't a complete abandonment of that training and that passion. I've been able to sing. Granted, it's been in lots of other different languages, and I've had to learn quickly how to adapt to different circles of musicians and different ways of doing things in Norway and Singapore and Germany and France. But that's been wonderful. But for my children and for generations that will follow those children, I'm left breathless thinking of how they are now prepared to be really in their place in the world. They aren't afraid of new cultures, new languages, encountering people who have very different philosophical approaches to living. They're at home with that. They're they're tolerant, and they realize that their English speaking, their Christianity, their Americanism, and their Mormonism, they aren't the norm for the whole world.
Yeah.
They're wonderful things, but they aren't the way that everyone in the world lives. And so when you see your identity, your core identity, in relief to the rest of the world that, oh, being blonde and blue-eyed and Nordic-looking, everyone in Mumbai doesn't look like me. And imagine, people in Vietnam, they don't really know a thing about my political leanings. They don't know a thing about my current political leanings. My religion, they don't even know what the name is. They have no hook on which to hang it. I think that's important for young people to learn in a world that's shrinking, right? We are becoming, thanks to technology, more interconnected. And for my children, I'm grateful that they have an idea of different cultures, different languages, different philosophies, different ways of being in the world. Yeah.
You bring up your children. Let's talk about Parker.
Let's talk about him. Let's
he was about your him. Firstborn.
Yes, he's the one that I put in a chest pack when he was six weeks old and took off for the Orient. So my husband and I moved to Hong Kong when he was 6 weeks old, and I nursed him in rat-infested alleyways in Wan Chai and...
you know, like you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah, like everyone can relate to that.
Those rats, no big deal. Are you done eating?
Okay. Right. So he's my firstborn, my boy, my child that sort of I cut my teeth on parenting with this little boy who was extremely energetic, percussive in utero, and never stopped. Just an intense, engaged personality. The most alive human being I've ever known. The most alive, engaged, passionate about this world and humanity as it is. And we moved with him then, and his younger sister, Claire, the one who's Sorella Bradford now in Rome, moved with them to Norway when Parker was 4 and Claire was 2, and threw them into Norwegian schools immediately. Church was in Norwegian. My work was in Norwegian. My husband's work was in Norwegian. So Parker and Claire became little Norwegian children.
Jeez.
They learned Norwegian really swiftly, as kids do in that age bracket, thank goodness, because their brains are really
absorbent. And just,
exactly. And so they became little Norwegian kids in the span of over 5.5 years that we lived there. Then we moved to France, and they had to learn French very quickly. And
is it a pretty easy transition, or is that
no? When you get to chapter,
I speak English and Ebonics, and that's about that's about as far as I go. I went to Cleveland on my mission, so understanding
did.
A little bit of Ebonics,
well,
I think is a language.
I'm thinking you are a multilingualist right there. Yeah. That's a polyglot. Yeah, as I write in at chapter 9, it's called L'Arrivée, that's the arrival into... do you mind if I read just a
Please.
Paragraph here? Moving from Norway to France meant trading in one splendid extreme for another, equally splendid but strikingly antithetical one. It was a move from the north to the south, from Nordic to Latin, from a calm island to the bustling Île-de-France, from the tundra to the Tuileries, from craggy fjords to the sleek Seine, from the untamed spirituality of Lofoten to the crafted symmetry of the Jardin de Versailles, from the land of the midnight sun to the land of the Sun King, from the stark homogeneity to vibrating variety, from two kinds of cheese to 378 plus, wow, from hot dogs to haute cuisine, from IKEA to Louis Le 16, from the comfy lilt of the economic Norwegian tongue to the highly stylized lavishness of Le Français, from cooperation to competition, from the community to the moi, which means me, from rigorous obedience to la révolution, from no-nonsense androgyny to the religion called la beauté, the beauty, from muddy park dress, which is a sort of a Eunice suit that all of the Norwegian kids wear so they can play in the snow from sunrise to sunset, to starched parochial uniforms, from sandals to Christian Louboutin strappy stilettos, from innocence to experience, from Eden to the world.
Hmm. So really similar.
Yeah, exactly. You just glide right into that one. So this was a, whoa, this was a yank whiplash experience, and that's where Parker and Claire and our third child born in Norway, Dalton, mm-hmm, is his name, Dalton Håkon Bradford, where they then needed to learn French.
Yeah. And the first real test of, okay, this is what we're doing, huh?
Yeah, that's right, folks. This is who we are, and we just pull up our bootstraps or our strappy stilettos, and we learn this. We integrate. That's what we Bradfords do. We don't live in a bubble. We integrate.
I don't want to be a Bradford.
Exactly. Give me another name.
Give me somebody else. Can I be a Dalton? Daltons
exactly.
Don't do this.
Can exactly. Didn't they stay in Utah?
Yeah.
So we learned, the children and I and Randall, my husband, we all learned these languages together. That's what we did. And I'm telling you, I cried a lot. And I used my children as support because children tend to learn very, very quickly. So the children and I would sit around our big Norwegian table and we would study this language together. And one of the little weird little rituals I had with myself was that as soon as I hit a new country, I would pray in that language. No matter if I only had four sentences, but I figured that God was a linguist and could figure out what was in my head.
I knew what you were saying.
He could probably
even though you
understand.
Just asked to bless the pig.
Exactly.
You know.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes. So we would learn that as a family. We put ourselves through that experience. And so with Parker, our eldest, we had this experience of learning Norwegian together and adapting to Norwegian culture and then learning French together and adapting to French culture. And it was at the end of our eight and a half years living in Paris that Parker was to attend university in the U.S. and he wanted to go to BYU, Idaho.
Oh, really?
For one semester, he wanted to go to a church school because he had never spent a great deal of time with Mormon kids.
Yeah.
And he thought, this will be exotic and novel.
Idaho
was exotic and novel. It was for him. He'd never
it's
seen
all perspective.
He'd never seen the likes.
Yeah.
He'd never seen the likes. And so he was enrolled there for a summer workshop before school was to begin in the end of August. We were in the middle of a move from that long-standing home in Paris to a new assignment in Munich. Literally the week where all of our goods were boxed with the words Paris, Arrow, Munich on them. My husband had stayed in Munich to deal with a lot of the logistics that go along with that, with signing forms and hooking up electricity, etc. And I had gone ahead to be with the children and to get them into camps and things. And Parker was in a water activity that week. It was the second week of this camp. He had been there for 9 days. He was in a water activity that was organized by a group of about 21 students. Again, Parker didn't know about what American kids do for fun. He didn't have a driver's license. He'd grown up taking the metro in Paris.
Sure.
Closest irrigation canal, if we can call it that, for him was the Seine River.
Okay.
A block from our home, running down the middle of Paris. And so these kids were all going to go swim in irrigation canals. That's what the local kids say you do for fun. And according to all the locals I've talked with, indeed, that's what you do. And there was one in particular where they went that night. There was a water hole, sort of a lagoon, at a place called Monkey Rock. And they were all there together having this activity. And Parker and another student were standing in one of these irrigation canals overlooking the lagoon when suddenly Parker readjusted his footing and disappeared. He was sucked under the water and pinned, sucked upstream countercurrent and pinned in a whirl under a little bridge. And this other student who was with him thought he was maybe kidding. He didn't know what was going on. He was perhaps 8 feet from him. And so this other student stepped forward to reach for him, and he, in turn, was sucked under.
Jeez.
And to abbreviate the story a little bit, what then happened was that Parker got out twice.
Was able to get his way out of the water.
He was able to pull himself out of this. It was a vortex, a hidden, what the locals call, I found this out later, what the locals call the meat grinder. Was private property, but unmarked, and all of the locals went there for fun. And they were pinned in this meat grinder, this vortex, in a very small place, very deep, under this single car, little gravel-covered bridge. And Parker was able, Parker, who was very athletic, co-captain of his volleyball team, co-captain of his basketball team, he was able to get out, and both times he went back in to try and save this friend. What happened at the end of this terrible experience, when all of the students were then aware that these two boys were pinned under the bridge, is that Parker was out and he created a human chain to go back in with him in the lead and someone else holding on to an embankment by the side of this canal. The chain broke, the human chain broke, and then four boys were drowning. Four boys were sucked in. So Parker and the original boy, and then two other students. Everyone was able to be pulled out or pushed out, but Park, the original boy who had been hit very badly and cut up, went over some waterfalls. He was revived by CPR very quickly, but for some reason that to this day we can't quite explain, Parker couldn't get out, even though he'd gotten out twice before. And he was underwater for a long time. And I got a phone call that night.
Oh my gosh.
At 11 o'clock. I had been tracked down. I had just arrived from Munich, been tracked down at my parents' home in Utah, and I was supposed to come as quickly as I could to Idaho. And so I drove through the night, and I contacted my husband back in Munich, and he then began trying to connect flights from Munich to a place called Pocatello, Idaho, where we'd never been before in our lives. Even though we're Utah kids, we'd never been there. We were able to congregate at the side of our boy, our very tall, very strong, beautiful boy, and many friends from around the United States were able to come in during the 38 hours that he lay in coma. And there were sacred things that we learned, that we experienced while we were there in that ICU, some of which I've written. I've written about some in the book, some about which I don't speak, some about which I've written, but in records that probably I'll only share with my posterity, but very sacred things happened, and I learned a great deal. And
Would you be willing to share one that is from the book, or share just an experience from it?
Yes, I will. I won't read it directly, but I experienced a gathering. There was a literal gathering that was going on with people that I could see. My aunt, Elaine Dalton, and her husband, Steve, drove up. They were with me. Friends that flew in from Boston, from California, from different places in the United States, family members from throughout Utah, my parents who had been on vacation in Colorado, drove 9 hours through the night when they got the message, and we all gathered. It was a very, very sacred time, very sacred time. There was a calm sensation, even though I felt myself dying.
Really?
I felt myself, I felt...
Like as a connection with Parker, that kind of thing?
Yes, I felt that... I felt very alive. It's so difficult to describe, Richie. It's very, it's something that explodes the limits of language, but I felt a connection with things spiritual and an understanding of the big picture, which was so clear. It was this billion pixel clarity image of how things really are. And I saw this sun as a grand, radiant being, and not just because I'm an adoring mother and this is who he is. It's because that's who we all are. That's who all human beings are, far more radiant, far more powerful, far better than we think we are, and that we judge one another to be. That is what I saw. But this idea of gathering that I experienced in concrete, undeniable terms was that there was light, and there was a fullness and a kind of a vibration that was in that room that was not in the hallway. If you walked out into the hallway, and other people that were there attest to this, it was like you passed through a plasma membrane, and then everything sounded and felt different in the hallway than it did in that sort of sacred cubicle where we were gathering around this altar upon which this body lay, this gurney with my son, my firstborn son. And something about that sensation of many others being there and around us wasn't my experience alone. It was what others there experienced. We gathered around his bed, and we were going to remove life support.
Yeah, I had read that, and that seems to me like that would be the hardest decision in the world to do. I mean, not only because you're the mother, and that's not, you know, you're supposed to pass away before your kids.
Yes, you are. That's the way nature teaches us our whole lives. We have the scroll of our life, of our child's life, unrolling in front of us all of the time. We're always writing that story ahead of our child. Mm-hmm. This is where he's going to be. This is what he's going to be doing that next year. To have that scroll there and then ripped off in front of you, it's beyond anything that I can possibly try to describe. It is so eviscerating. And at the same time that we anticipated this was going to happen, it happened, I also felt a steady that somehow this was going to be... This was going to happen. I almost said it's going to be okay. It's not okay. That would be flippant to say that. Mm-hmm. But we were going to survive this, and he was going to be present in our lives forever. And I rested on the many promises that we've made, temple promises that we've made that are sacred to me. They're real to me, and I felt them in full Dolby sense around in that moment. When we gathered there around his gurney, and we were told, Mr. and Mrs. Bradford, chance of meaningful for survival, less than 2%. So this kid who spoke these languages, who'd been, like I've described to you, the most alive person I'd ever known, he was now going to be no more. Someone started speaking of him already in the past tense. They said, he was so something. My brain could not process a verb in the past tense in the same phrase with my son, whose body was still warm in front of me. Mm-hmm. I couldn't process it. I wanted to take a sofa and hurl it through a wall. Instead, I started singing. Mm. And it wasn't something that I planned. I started singing a church hymn, of all things. It was this natural inclination of me. I had sung a lot with Parker. He's a drummer, too. Mm. And we'd performed in rock bands together.
Oh, really?
He'd grown up sitting on the front row, watching his mom sing on the stage his whole life. His whole life. And so there I was at the foot of my child's majestic, beautiful Adonis body, covered with a white sheet. And I started singing, I know that my Redeemer lives. And everyone that was in the room started singing. And then we sang children's songs from the church in the languages that he sang them in. So in Norwegian and in French, we sang, I am a child of God. We'd sang other favorite church hymns. And then we knew that it was time to give him back. That he wasn't ours in the first place, to give him back. And that gathering sort of held me together. In the book, I describe it as that sensation, you know, when you've been on a beach and you dig deep holes and you stick your legs all the way up to your hip, you go all the way down in the sand with the sand around you, and it's wet and it's compact and it's dense. And you feel like no matter what wave came, you wouldn't be knocked over because, look, you're hip deep. Mm-hmm. In rock solid sand. And I had that sensation of being held up, that whatever was going to happen, we were not going to be knocked completely over. And that has, over the long run, that's held true. Over the short run, I could barely walk the next day.
Physically,
the blow is so devastating. And I think it's because spirit has been ripped from spirit. I have all sorts of theories about this, but spirit has been torn from spirit, and the natural blood of your spirit is tears. So we cried, all of us cried nonstop for, I think it was month 19 when I wrote in my journal, I can't believe I haven't cried today. And I sobbed and I gagged and I wept the next day, but there was a lot of fluid that was lost over almost 2 years straight. So it's extremely painful physically. Chest cramps, heart palpitations, shaking. My signature has since changed. We had to go to doctors, and the doctor said, you know that this will forever be part of your medical history. Just be aware of that, that you need to let your doctors know that you have experienced this sort of trauma for a parent. This is a major trauma, and you will feel it in your body. So just be aware of that. So my husband started walking hunched over. He aged about 30 years in a month. He lost 16 kilos, so that's about 35 pounds in less than 2 months. So the physical blow is marked and you carry it for a long time, hardly can walk, can't sleep, can't eat, and can do nothing but cry or sit in silence for a long time, a long time.
And you speak about the gathering. I mean, with that, the gathering, they're being there for you and as a physical support, but then those people leave and then it's you,
yes,
your husband,
yes,
and your kids,
and
in a foreign country,
thank
trying
you
to deal with.
That's it. That's it. That's it. In fact, the chapter that deals with that is called Monastery, because we walked out of a funeral, a beautiful funeral that was this turbocharge of spirit. And Parker's presence, which we had prayed for, we had prayed that Parker's spirit and his new friends would be present. And I'll tell you, they were there.
Yeah.
They were there. I will never deny that. I'll say that to the face of anyone. There was a spiritual presence that we felt. We walked out of that wonderful funeral where everyone was there and loving and weeping with us. It hurt them as well that the universe had been shot through with a cannonball. Mm. They recognized that there was a black hole.
Yeah.
That was comforting for us. Then we walked onto an airplane. Days later, we got off the airplane on a new planet. On a new planet that was the planet of grief, but on top of that, it was everything that was new. We were now in Germany. It was a new language. It was a new church community, a new school. No one knew whether we always walked around catatonic and zombies, and that we always wept through every church meeting, and that we always tried to avoid social contact. Why? Because we couldn't talk about trivia. I couldn't small talk. It was either talk about the realities of humanity, life and death. Don't talk to me about vegetable trays. I can't do it. I can't bear it. I can't talk about steel-belted radial tires. I can't talk about anything but the essentials that are the forefront of my brain all of the time, and that is this boy, and that is life and death as they really are. So that was very, very hard. We retreated into a monastery, which I see as appropriate that we moved to Munich, because do you know what the word Munich comes from?
I don't.
It means München. Monks founded Munich. So it was the city of monks, and we sort of retreated into our monk life existence and sent the children to school, but the rest of the time hunkered down and held together very tightly. It was torture. It was full-blown medieval torture that I resented at that time. I thought, I can't believe that God would inspire us to move to this place at exactly this time. So we left most of our moving boxes packed, ready to move back to our community in Paris, until we received a clear signal that no, it was a divine signal. I can say that here, can't I?
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, I can. I'm looking into the eyes of someone who knows. A divine signal that said, no, don't. You need to stay here. In wisdom, this will bless you. And I thought, I am not liking the looks of these blessings. Curse me instead, because the blessings are not what I want.
Right.
They aren't at all. But looking back, I realized that sort of monastery, that sort of existence where no one expected anything from me.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know that I'm normally the hostess and the entertainer and the one who takes a number of responsibilities at school and church and community all at once. I was not that woman. What I got to do instead was I got to dive heart and head first into this experience of grief. I took care of my family and my children, and as soon as they went off to work or to school, I started studying. I started studying everything I could from scripture and wise spiritual leaders and everyone throughout the history of humanity who has spoken about this topic of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did for weeks and months on end.
Wow.
And I started collecting ideas about eventually that I would write about in a book about grief and loss and adaptation. That for me was a great, great blessing, because I became strong. And after 6 months of studying and hunkering down and gaining a spiritual center that was filled back up again, I could approach my church leaders and say, all right, I'm going to be of no use to anyone if I remain in my monastery for too long. Can I serve in some way? I need to talk about the things we've experienced. And they said, that's great, Sister Dalton Bradford.
Yeah.
That's great, because we have 5 positions for you to fill.
Oh.
How do you feel about that? And that for me, you would think, well, that's obsessive and compulsive, or that's right. really, that's a high achiever. But those positions that allowed me to teach and share what we had experienced were healing for me. They were healing because I got to speak about this boy, but I also got to speak about all that had blessed us and how indeed we can trust God. We can trust God. I had been crossing the river and I knew that the bottom of that river was sound. You can cross it. And that was the beginning sort of a slow ascent for our family out of that very dark place. It doesn't mean that it was a consistent ascent, because you fall back down and sure. and the tides of grief come and grab you around the ankles and suck you back out into the middle of the ocean again, and you're dog paddling and you make your way back to solid ground. So it's a very erratic, unpredictable trajectory, this thing called grief. And it. But what I'm grateful for is that I was able to confront it. I didn't run from it. I didn't try to dance the jolly jig around it.
Everything's fine. Yeah.
Everything's fine. No one likes a frowny face. Change it to a smile.
Yeah, right.
Right. No. Jesus wept. Mm-hmm. And that's our model. And that is compassion. And that's the heart of being human. And it's the heart of being divine, too. I'm absolutely convinced of that. So this was a blessing then, which felt like a torturous, cruel twist of fate at the beginning. Yeah. This was a blessing to be able to confront it, study it, feel it, and then share that with others. So that's where you come to this point where you can then be sitting in a studio with someone talking about it openly and sharing and hoping that you can be of help in some way to someone else. You know?
Do you have a calling in your ward right now?
Right now, I don't have a calling in my ward because I was primary president the month we were there. Now I'm Stake Young Women's president.
Oh, geez.
In fact, just 10 days ago, I was camping with a bunch of darling French and Swiss girls in tents in the Swiss mountains. There you go.
Wow.
Got on a plane the next day and flew to Salt Lake City with 17 mosquito bites up and down my shins. Smell of campfire in my hair.
I can't smell it.
No, you can't.
It's been a few days.
Just because I'm on this side of the table.
Yeah. If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or one that would be made up, what would you pick for yourself?
Oh, I love teaching gospel doctrine. But I love teaching gospel doctrine to primary children and to Relief Society sisters and to the entire ward and to young women. So wherever I can be talking about gospel doctrine, that's where I want to be. I love it.
Is there a book with the gospel doctrine? Because there's the four different, you can do, right? Gospel doctrine, yeah.
Yes.
Book of Mormon or New Testament,
yes,
or Old Testament. Do you have one that...
Divvy up the scriptures, yes, that's right. I love to teach the Book of Mormon.
Okay.
But I love to teach the New Testament, and I really got into the Old Testament during this period.
Sorry, you got
to
pick. You can't love
pick.
Them all.
All right. I know you're a church history buff, though.
Yes.
So you love Doctrine and Covenants, right?
Mm-hmm.
You think I haven't been doing my study?
Yeah, I can tell. Jeez, I'm flattered.
I know your blood type. I know your blood type.
And then finally, what is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of my faith. Now, you're going to really get me teary here. My favorite part of my faith is prayer. Prayer is the soul's sincere desire. I think that all souls want to commune with the greater divine. And it has been in prayer, when I've been rendered silent in grief, where I realize there is a language there that connects me with my God. Prayer for me has been oxygen, but it's been more than that. There's a wonderful quote by an Episcopalian pastor, I believe he's Episcopalian, wrote a fabulous book on prayer called Turning the Diamond, based on a George Herbert poem.
Okay.
The author himself is George Lennon, and he uses these words. A soul without prayer is like a body without blood. And that, for me, is how vital prayer is for me. It is the dialogue that gives me my celestial networking, where social networking can kind of diffuse me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
That celestial networking is dependent upon prayer. That is where I have encountered God as real in my life, and has guided me and has sustained me. My family has answered and given clear-cut revelation, clear-cut messages to me, and comfort and reassurance. If I have to narrow it down to one thing, it would be that. Yes.
The name of the book is Global Mom, Melissa Dalton Bradford. Tell people where they can find you or find the book, all that stuff.
Oh, this is great. Thanks for asking that question. It's available on Amazon in digital and hard copy version, as well as an audio version, which I recorded myself in a studio in France.
I did. So if you love her voice, you can get
there
the
you
entire
go.
Book
and
with
I
her
sing
voice.
In it. I sing in it as well. I sing some little ditties in it. You can buy it at any of your conventional bookstores. I'm going to hop over to King's English today and talk with wonderful Betsy Burton there. And make sure that I can, maybe I can get a book signing in one of the bookstores around here. But you should be able to pick it up at your conventional bookstore and Audible, which is Amazon. Mm-hmm. Amazon's Audible .com is where you can get the audio version.
Can you do you also have like a Facebook page for it?
I do. That's you are my best friend. You're letting me tell everyone about this.
You must.
Yes, the Facebook page is Global Mama Memoir. My blog is Melissa Writes of Passage. So writes as in schreiben or écrire or skriver or schier.
Or writes or for writes. Those of us.
The one that's where she writes stuff. That's how they say it in Cleveland.
Yeah. Starts with a W. Yes, Melissa Writes of Passage. That's where I am regularly. And I've written extensively about grief there, but also I've given direct excerpts from the book.
Cool.
So you have this global experience plus a concentrated segment of those posts that is about grief.
Cool.
Yes.
Well, we hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back row. We really gotta go on the Cultural Hall show.